Support for this episode comes from T-Mobile, and they've got something that baseball fans are going to want to hear about. Right now, T-Mobile is giving customers a free MLB TV subscription. That means you can watch tons of games live or on demand in HD. Get all the baseball you can handle and access to America's largest and fastest 5G network with T-Mobile. Visit T-Mobile.com/MLB to score your free MLB TV by April 5th. Qualifying customers can access the T-Mobile Tuesdays app to sign up for MLB TV. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Awarded fastest 5G by Open Signal Awards based on average speeds in USA 5G experience report, January 2021. Details at T-Mobile.com.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rob Wolf, and welcome to episode number 46 of Unformidable, where we take a look at some of the less heralded Mets in our beloved franchise's ever quirky history. Because to us, every player who dons the orange and blue is, in their own way, unformidable. We have opening day almost upon us, and while it isn't quite 2019 in the world of optimism as far as health and ability to enjoy public events, it at least feels possible to hope this will be a safe and complete baseball season this year and not the strange and truncated 2020 season. And vaccines and reasonable crowd size maintenance, I'm hopeful I might even see the inside of my beloved Citi Field this year, as I expect many of my fellow Met fans are. And if opening day is a source of optimism for anyone who loves baseball, you can forgive Met fans if we're a little more optimistic than others for one day of the year, because if there's one day on the calendar in which a Met fan can wake up and feel almost statistically guaranteed to enjoy a victory, it's, of course, opening day. Probably, I'm guessing, the most successful date game number on the Met calendar. Game one on the schedule certainly has a cachet and winds up being more memorable to most than, say, game 41 on the schedule. Perhaps the Mets have a better game 41 record than game one, but no one remembers that. And if you're going to be an unformidable type candidate, that is, you know, someone who perhaps didn't spend that much time with the Mets, didn't necessarily excel here, or had scant few memorable moments with the franchise, if there's a day to have a memorable moment and have your name remain somewhere on the outskirts of team lore, it would surely be opening day. And that's exactly what Colin Cowgill did a scant 9 openers ago. Making me feel very old, Colin Cowgill was born in an auspicious year, 1986, April 28th, 1986 to be exact, in Lexington, Kentucky, making him, like the Mets' previous championship, 34 years old, soon to turn 35. Colin didn't travel far to attend college, sticking in Lexington to attend the University of Kentucky. Even as an exceptional athlete at 5'9", I'm guessing he perhaps was not a candidate for their more prestigious basketball team, but Cowgill excelled on the college diamond for the Wildcats, getting drafted as a junior by the Oakland A's in the 29th round of the 2007 June draft. But he elected to return to school and improved his stock, getting drafted in the 5th round in 2008 by the Arizona Diamondbacks. As a senior drafted in this slaughter area, Cowgill likely was looked at as more of an organizational depth piece, perhaps a possible bench player or fourth outfielder at his peak, which ultimately would represent pretty much exactly what he would become in his professional career. However, his minor league star did flare a bit brightly for a short time, as Cowgill flashed a decent power-speed combo in the minors, and then when you further factor in his very strong minor league walk-to-strikeout ratio and contact rates, combined perhaps also with the larger baseball-wide timing of the analytic moneyball approach starting to become more embraced industry-wide, it combined, to make many people look at Cowgill as a potentially underrated and underappreciated prospect, in particular as it amounts to his size. You know, that at 5'9", He might have been overlooked due to that factor, but that the numbers seem to indicate a potential underrated or breakout player. And, you know, then, of course, there's the prospect bias of he was in a highly touted first-round draft pick. But he had a standout 2011 season in the minor leagues, definitely aided by his time in the Pacific Coast League in general and his home park of Reno in particular. But in, I think, 98 games, he hit 13 homers, stole 30 bases, and had a .354, .430, .554 slash line. In a report feature on him, the always astute John Sickles acknowledged the PCL home boost, including the fact that his OPS at home was over 1.109, but noted that Cowgill had a strong throwing arm, above average speed, sound plate discipline, and again, that scouts tend to be suspicious of small right-handed hitters. So Sickles ultimately concluded with his speed, pop, and defensive versatility, he would fit perfectly into a fourth outfield role, but given his performance to date, he deserves at least one shot as a regular. And in fact, Cowgill's excellence in the minors in 2011 did earn him a call-up to Arizona in July for a team that was actually in the thick of a pennant race. He made his debut on July 28th and would get semi-regular playing time, short end of a left field platoon and a pinch hitter off the bench, getting his first career hit on July 31st, 2011 as a pinch hitter against the Dodgers' Scott Elbert, later hitting his first career home run against Corey Lupke and the Padres on August 28th, 2011. The Diamondbacks won their division in 2011, which I had zero recollection of till I researched this podcast, and Cowgill would actually make their postseason roster, I would have to guess, as essentially their 25th man. He appeared in two games in the NLDS, one as a defensive replacement, and in the other, he had his only career postseason at bat, hitting a clutch big two-run single off of Randy Wolf in Game 4 against the Milwaukee Brewers, giving the Diamondbacks a couple of insurance runs in a game they'd went on to win 10-6. The team would lose a heartbreaker in Game 5 of the NLDS to the Milwaukee Brewers of Ryan Braun and Prince Fielder and miss a chance to advance to the NLCS, and that was Cowgill's only career postseason at-bat, so career 1,000 hitter in the postseason. At 25, Cowgill was a little old to be a big-time prospect, but the A's had drafted him earlier, were clearly still enamored, and in the offseason of 2011, Cowgill got traded to Oakland as kind of the main, I think, piece in a five-player trade that brought Arizona pitcher Trevor Cahill, who was a young starter, 1 year removed from an 18-8 season, although he had poor peripherals, advanced metrics looked at him as a good sell-high candidate, and probably even gave Cowgill a little more cachet in that the A's, of course, always seemed to know more than most people, particularly those days. That would be a Billy Beane move that did not work out too well for the A's. Not that Cahill really excelled. He was kind of an innings-eater type starter for Arizona, but Cowgill struggled with injuries in 2012, struggled on the field when he played, and never really seemed like maybe that one chance to be an everyday player that Sickles and other observers thought he might deserve might be passing by at age 26. But enter one more factor that would give Cowgill a brief chance to be an everyday player. That is a franchise reeling from the financial fallout of the Bernie Madoff affair and a GM trying to balance multiple balls and implement a bargain basement Moneyball approach to keep a team afloat, even while preserving the fiction that the Mets weren't really hamstrung by the Wilpons' financial woes. Never really saying they were, or you know, really 100% committing to rebuilding, really from Sandy Alderson's hiring in October 29th, 2010, through the first few years of his GM-ship, the team really consistently spent their off-seasons bringing in a bunch of these under-the-radar potential gems, from Brad Emus before the 2011 season. All these implications that these players might have a vague, underappreciated aspect, or that Sandy was doing that money, taking that moneyball approach and going to find diamonds in the rough and not that the Mets could barely afford to run a franchise. But at any rate, Colin Cowgill became the latest in that string on December 18th, 2012, when the Mets acquired him for Jeffrey Marte, at the time a very young prospect, a toolsy prospect in low A, that had some future and of course did have a brief major league career of his own, but got traded for Colin Cowgill. Of course, a much more notable Mets transaction occurred in December of 2012, and that is that the Wilpons scoured the couch cushions, sold enough pieces of the team or whatever to successfully extend beloved franchise icon David Wright in the offseason. It was in December of 2012 that Wright signed his $138 million contract, 7 years, $122 million, with a club option picked up for 2013, and extended the franchise, Tom Seaver's a franchise, it extended the icon, the captain, and our beloved David Wright. But obviously the Mets didn't have a lot of money elsewhere that offseason, and in fact reactions to Cowgill's acquisition ranged from snark, including people pointing out that the Mets' highest-paid outfielders for 2013 were Bobby Bonilla and Jason Bay. Man, people love those Bobby Bonilla references. But also there were those, the people who were really committed to the Sandy rebuild and approach, and that, this was going to be a savvy, under-the-radar pickup where this was just someone who needed a chance to get everyday at-bats and, could perhaps potentially flourish. And Cowgill proceeded to have an excellent spring training in 2013 to win the center field job outright, and it looked like it could be more of the latter. It could be, a clever pickup. Now, I tend to be a skeptical Met fan, so I don't understand how one couldn't be, to be perfectly frank. But that's for us to discuss elsewhere outside of here. But any skepticism to the effect that the Cowgill move would be pointless might have melted away a bit as of opening day of 2013.
When you know your game is on, but tracking it down on TV is impossible, baseball season starts to feel more like hide-and-go-seek than, baseball season. Thankfully, the days of missing innings while you hunt for your game are over with T-Mobile. Here's the thing. Nobody connects baseball fans to Major League Baseball like T-Mobile. Why? For the last 6 years, they've given their customers a free subscription to MLB TV. That's right, free. T-Mobile customers can score free MLB TV when they redeem by April 5th. That means you can watch tons of games live or on demand in HD. In other words, T-Mobile is your ticket to the game. So if you're the baseball fan you say you are, but you haven't made the switch to T-Mobile, I'm not sure what to tell you. But there's time to turn it around before opening week. Get all the baseball you can handle and access to America's largest and fastest 5G network with T-Mobile. Visit T-Mobile.com/MLB to switch and score free MLB TV today. Qualifying customers can access the T-Mobile Tuesdays app to sign up for MLB TV. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Awarded fastest 5G by Open Signal Awards based on average speeds in USA 5G Experience Report, January 2021. Details at T-Mobile.com.
The Mets opened the 2013 season at home on April 1st against the San Diego Padres, and it was infinitely more successful than their Citi Field debut home opener in 2009 against the San Diego Padres. Colin Cowgill wore number 4 and patrolled center field like Lenny Dykstra before him on opening day, the first batter of the season at Citi Field, and he did pop out to second in his first at-bat and strike out in his second at-bat. But then later on, Cowgill came alive. With the team already ahead 4-1, Cowgill doubled off the top of the left field wall in the bottom of the fourth, would have driven in a run if the base runner were not Jonathan Neese, as I remember watching from the upper deck. It wasn't Bartolo Colon speed, but it was not too impressive. But Cowgill's double would kick off a rally that would produce 3 more runs, giving the Mets a 7-1 lead and a shocking opening day runaway that became even more of a laugher later on in the bottom of the seventh, when Cowgill once again went very deep to left field, launching a grand slam just over the orange line. And I'm not sure the years when, you know, when all the painting and the lines and the rules went into effect in Citi Field, but I remember being at the game and being very confused. And in fact, the players were just running around the bases, and I don't think it was until Cowgill got to like third that the umpires signaled home run and had to verify that, yes, the ball just crossed over the orange line for a grand slam home run, giving the Mets an 11-2 lead, and Cowgill a very impressive 2-for-5, 2 runs scored, 4 RBI, opening day smash debut. It marked the first grand slam by a Met in the first game of his Met career, and I believe it was the first opening day grand slam by any Met in 18 years. And it may have seemed to augur well, but it was absolutely Colin Cowgill's high water mark as a New York Met. I have to say, though, for what was ultimately a terrible season, the Mets finished 2013 with a 74-88 record. I remember 2013, or at least the first two-thirds of it, relatively fondly for a poor Met season. I remember really the first year that Citi Field really felt like home. Again, I don't remember when they started, you know, painting the orange and, you know, correcting the field and making it more Metsian. But more importantly, I remember that being a truly rollicking opening day, and, you know, 11-2 win will do that and make you optimistic, even if your team doesn't seem to have all the pieces. But particularly because, of course, the development of Matt Harvey. The first game I attended in 2013 was opening day. The second game I attended in 2013 was on April 19th, which many of us will fondly remember much more as the Harvey's Better game, when Matt Harvey outdueled Steven Strasburg. And again, you know, just Met fans and, you know, Citi Field, which seemed a little moribund its first few seasons, except for maybe R.A. Dickey the season before. You know, Matt Harvey really gave the Mets some appointment TV. I still remember being stuck at work late on May 7th for a game I wanted to attend and getting texts from my friend just saying he's going to do it and being like, just knowing, oh, Matt Harvey is throwing a no-hitter. Actually was throwing a perfect game against the White Sox for 6 2/3 until an infield single. And of course, the Citi Field hosted the All-Star game that year, once again, started by Matt Harvey, also featuring David Wright as All-Star ambassador. And 2013 was also really David Wright's last David Wright season, where he was a well-deserved All-Star, you know, not just an ambassador for the Mets. He had an over 900 OPS that year and over 5 WAR. It was really his last healthy, hearty, full David Wright season. So they had Harvey and Wheeler. They had traded for Noah Syndergaard at the cost of the beloved R.A. Dickey. Seemed like the franchise was on an upswing, potentially, if they could ever spend some money. However, I was also at a game in August when news started filtering through the crowd that Matt Harvey was going to need Tommy John surgery that year, and it seemed like all of the hope and promise that was building was about to get short-circuited. But I digress, because the podcast is not quite about Matt Harvey, but you know, just like the 2013 season starting with a bang and ending very sourly for the Mets, the 2013 season started with a bang and much more suddenly and quickly ended sourly for Colin Cowgill, who would not be with the Mets in August of 2013. Cowgill struggled mightily after opening day. By May 1st, he had been sent back down to AAA. He not only lost his job, got sent down to AAA Vegas to try and get himself straightened out. Did come back up to the big league club for a bit, but by late June, the Mets had designated Cowgill for assignment and traded him to the Los Angeles Angels after they claimed him for minor leaguer Kyle Johnson. All in all, as a Met, Cowgill appeared in 23 games, 63 plate appearances, and he slashed 180, 206, 311 for a 518 OPS and a very disappointing 45 OPS plus. So if you take out that opening day production, I can only imagine what those numbers are. But again, if you're going to have one good day, you may as well make it opening day. And you'll be remembered a bit more than some others. Cowgill's numbers with the Angels in 2013 were similar, played in 50 games, hit .231, two homers, and 91 at-bats. But he did have a decent 2014 for them, actually the best full major league year of his career. He went into spring training competing with J.B. Shook to be the Angels' fourth outfielder, and won the competition and won an opening day spot on the roster for the Angels. And in 293 plate appearances over 106 games in 2014, Cowgill had a 99 OPS plus, basically league average hitter, which again was really the at age 28, his best full major league season. Spent pretty much the whole season in the majors, and again made the postseason roster for a team that made the division series. He appeared in one game as a pinch runner defensive replacement, but did not get an at-bat, preserving that 1,000 career postseason batting average, but sadly not getting to experience championship series or World Series play in his major league career. 2015 played out a little more like 2013 for Cowgill, where he made the Angels opening day roster. More like 2014, not as a starting player, but as their fourth outfielder. Unfortunately, his production was more 2013 level. He struggled, only had 74 plate appearances over 50 games before being sent down to AAA, and didn't make it back up to the big league club in 2015. During that offseason, the Cleveland Indians purchased his rights and brought him to Cleveland. Again, Cowgill, perhaps had some King of Spring Training vibe going for him, now that I think about it, because he really was exceptional in 2013 spring training for the Mets, but he once again made the team out of spring training, but this time he went 1-for-12 over 9 games with Cleveland, obviously had a very short leash, and those were his final big league appearances. Cowgill did stick it out in professional baseball for 3 more years, bouncing around the Phillies, the Nationals, and the Padres organizations in 2017, 2018, and 2019, but never got more major league playing time. Prior to the 2020 season, Cowgill actually joined the Seattle Mariners organization on a minor league deal, but never received a promotion to the club during the abbreviated season, and of course there was no minor league season to speak of last year, so 2019 was his last year on the field in organized ball. He was officially part of the Mariners organization in 2020, and now to make a next generation feel old, just as I did when I remember going to ball games and seeing, Lloyd Mosby standing in the coaching box, 34-year-old Colin Cowgill is now the manager for the Mariners' AA affiliate in Arkansas, officially ending his playing career and making him a manager. So, yeah. Time moves fast, doesn't it? For the entirety of his major league career, Colin Cowgill recorded a 2.9 WAR, according to Baseball Reference. That is over 689 major league at-bats. He hit 12 home runs, drove in 57 runs, stole 14 bases, and he had a career slash line of .234, .297, .329 for a .627 OPS. Again, I think I gave you most of those numbers as they met already. I can tell you that in a scant 23 games, he did record a negative 0.5 BWAR, according to Baseball Reference, in those 63 plate appearances. So, disappointing Mets tenure for Colin Cowgill. Again, speaking to the fact, if you're going to do something good, I guess either do it at the beginning or in a, George Costanza fashion, leave him wanting more, get in a good final at bat and say your goodnights and hit the road. Colin Cowgill did the former, and for that, he will always be just a little bit unformidable. Hope someone else pulls a Colin Cowgill this opening day in a few days. Some unknown player has a glorious day. Our Stars have great days. We win 11-2. And more importantly, it's a much more successful season on a whole, as the 2013 season, but we shall see. Thank you for taking the time to listen to Unformidable, everyone. Please go to AmazonAvenue.com for more Mets-related content. Follow Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find this and all of our amazing pods wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe and leave a review if you can. It really helps us out. Original music by Bunga. I'm on Twitter at Wolf, WOLFFRR, and the show is at Unformidable. Thank you, and as always, let's go Mets!
Thanks to T-Mobile for sponsoring this episode and for connecting fans to Major League Baseball like no one else. Right now, T-Mobile customers can score a free subscription to MLB TV when they redeem by April 5th. Where else can you watch tons of games and get access to the largest, fastest 5G network in America? Only with T-Mobile. Start opening week off right. Visit T-Mobile.com/MLB to score your free MLB TV today. Qualifying customers can access the T-Mobile Tuesdays app to sign up for MLB TV. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Awarded fastest 5G by Open Signal Awards based on average speeds in USA 5G Experience Report January 2021. Details at T-Mobile.com.